The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to IMC. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to sit here quietly, sit here with all of you. So can you hear me okay? Loud enough? I came back from teaching a retreat yesterday, a week-long retreat at our retreat center in Santa Cruz. And the theme of the retreat was equanimity, in the sense that the talks we gave, six Dharma talks, were all on the topic of equanimity, different forms of it. And that topic is still on my mind, and still thinking a little bit about that retreat. One of the... there were some jokes made at the retreat about how equanimity, one way or the other, set up or was responsible for the power outage that happened down there. The power went off at the retreat on Saturday evening. But we knew it was happening earlier, so Saturday morning, we told everyone at the retreat that what we knew, because some people came from places where the electricity was come off, maybe they wanted to go home, and maybe the fish aquarium needed to be, you know, taken care of or something important, or maybe they were just kind of worried about staying at the retreat center when this thing was happening. So we told them, and one of the interesting things that seemed to happen to a number of people was some of them were quite happy to, we gave people the option to leave, and some people did leave. The people who stayed were very glad that we kept the retreat going. There was some discussion about ending the retreat Saturday because of maybe we can't have a retreat if there's no electricity. As many people who stayed were very, very grateful to. It felt like more of an oasis of equanimity. And but also there were some people for whom the whole news about electricity going out, and fires in California, made them very anxious, and some of them, it was kind of interesting to see how some people, once they're anxious, it gets spreads out into other areas, and so it wasn't just the issue of the immediate issue of no electricity. There was a fear of, is there going to be danger for us to, a fire now. And we'd be close to fire, was going to be fire there. We were kind of surrounded by, at least on a few sides, by places that were not going to lose electricity, just 5 minutes away. And some people asked if we had evacuation plans for an earthquake. So, the connection between losing electricity and earthquakes is a little bit distant, but I sympathize. I mean, it was an example. There's so much anxiety in our world these days by some people, and the way that anxiety sometimes begets more anxiety. Anxiety kind of spreads out, and then we're concerned with other things, and it would also stood kind of a juxtaposition that what happened at the retreat center, and there was a lot of activity getting it ready for the electricity going out, and shops to Home Depot to get lanterns and discussions about the generator we have and what parts of the building the generator provide electricity to and what it doesn't, and if it doesn't have electricity for the fire alarm, then could we stay at the retreat? Should we stay in this building if we had no fire alarm working? And so there was a lot of discussion, a lot of activity going on, And the theme of the retreat was equanimity, to be equanimous. So for some people, that theme of equanimity in the abstract can seem boring. It can seem like it's a kind of indifference or kind of aloofness or kind of like just toned down and kind of just like just kind of chilled in such a way that, you know, you want to shake them and, you know, get them you know, a little bit more activated and animated. And but if you talk about not so much about equanimity, but about the opposite. If the opposite is to be anxious, if the opposite is to be restless or agitated, would you like to kind of overcome the anxiety? Would you like to kind of settle the mind, not be restless and not be agitated? If the opposite is to be reactive, being intensely for things or intensely against things, if the opposite of equanimity is to have such strong desires or such strong aversions that everything else, kind of all other options, close down and we're kind of obsessing about these things. If equanimity is simply the absence of all those things, does it seem more attractive? And in some ways it might be more attractive, because if equanimity is a thing, is a state, then people might feel like I'm limited by the state. But if instead we talk about the absence of these other qualities, then it's not limited to anything. Then it can be all kinds of things that could be. It's just we're not having all these difficult states present. Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on equanimity. And our tradition in particular, they have lists of equanimity, different kinds of equanimity. And equanimity is part of the treasure trove of Buddhism. The treasure trove of Buddhism is your own treasure trove. It's turns out there's a lot of treasure in you. And equanimity is just a piece of all these different beautiful virtues, beautiful qualities that live inside of us. And I was reflecting on this treasure trove and how people out in the world will spend years chasing treasures. You know, if you find in the attic of your grandparents' great-grandparents' home a rolled-up parchment of a pirate map that's been long forgotten, and it has the you know the dot 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 and the X marks the spot and. Some people would, you know, could spend a fortune, to, you know, figuring it out, spending, you know, it's a big puzzle, right? Kind of finding your way, hoping to get that treasure. It's buried in the sand somewhere. And it could be years of searching. That we have read about people who spend years and years searching for some lost treasure and shipwreck or something. So we have a treasure inside. And there is a kind of treasure map to find it. Sit down and close your eyes and breathe mindfully. And spend time really looking and getting to know yourself and settling in and awakening or discovering your capacities for, you know, what are the lists of equanimity? There, equanimity is a tenth of the 10 paramis, 10 treasures. So the first is generosity, considered to be a beautiful form of wealth. And it's a little bit paradoxical to call generosity wealth, because it means giving things away. But no matter how poor one is, if one feels like one can give, that makes you, in Buddhist terms, that makes you wealthy. And if a person is phenomenally wealthy, but is miserly, then they're considered poor. So the first is generosity. The second is ethical integrity. The third is renunciation. And I think many people don't think of renunciation as a treasure. It feels more like, some people's, I think, image of being a renunciant, renouncing is the opposite of having treasure. It's kind of being impoverished. But to think of letting go, the ability not to hold on to things, the ability to be comfortable with simplicity, the ability to be at ease without electricity, without all the things that electricity brings. That's a kind of renunciation. Okay, well, our plans are different. We're going to sit here in the dark today. Okay. And so then another these 10 wisdoms are is 10 treasures is wisdom. And then there is effort, energy, vitality. It's interesting that the word equanimity comes from Latin, meaning having a balanced or even animus. Equanimous comes from the word animus. So they're equally animated in a balanced way. So energetically, balanced energy. The next is patience. And then truth. The treasure of being truth and knowing, being truthful. The treasure of resolve, to be able to make a determination and follow through on things. And the treasure of loving kindness. And then the tenth is equanimity. And they say that equanimity purifies loving kindness. Isn't that nice? Rather than losing all your love, if you're equanimous, it actually purifies it, makes it clean. They say because you're not going to be caught up in being preferential. You'll treat everyone equally, and so that's a kind of a pure loving kindness. It treats everyone with kindness, with love, with friendliness. There's other lists, and one other thing, characteristics of equanimity when it appears in Buddhist lists, equanimity is always the last one, or appears near the end, and so there's a 7 factors of awakening, and these 7 factors of awakening. So these 10 treasures are listed first, the paramis. They're a lot to do with how we live our lives. The 7 factors of awakening are about how we engage in meditation. And these 7 factors of awakening are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, concentration, and tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So equanimity. With the 7 factors of awakening, it has to do with being able to engage in meditation practice in a continuous way, to stay in there and not be thrown off by anything that comes up, not be dissuaded that the task at hand is to stay present in the moment, and not to get involved going off into other thoughts, other ideas, other concerns. Hold the course. And the example I like is that of being in a ship. And it is that if you're on a boat going across water, the bow of the boat plows through the water and the water washes off the side of the boat. And the water doesn't stop the boat, but just the boat doesn't stop for the water, it just washes everything by. With the 7 factors of awakening, with equanimity in particular, we hold the course of whatever happens in meditation practice, and we don't let anything get in the way. So we just fall off to the side. We let everything kind of like, so we're going along in meditation, staying in the present moment, and we think, what am I going to have for dinner? And the mind gets stopped. Or what happened yesterday? What's going to happen tomorrow? Or, is there going to be an earthquake? And so we're no longer staying on the course. We're no longer staying with the breath, stay here with the breath, stay in the present moment. Just be mindful, be mindful. And the ability to be equanimous in 7 factors of awakening has a lot to do with not getting distracted, not getting sidetracked, holding the course. And equanimity has this factor of holding together these other qualities, mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, and concentration, and keeping them on track, because those are the kind of the elements of the boat. And all these beautiful qualities we have, stay here, just keep going through the water, plowing into the next present moment. And so if time is the water we swim in, then we're staying, so we're just keep going into the next moment, into the next moment. A way of losing the next moment is retrospective thinking. So if you're kind of like going along and suddenly you have an itch and you start wondering, that's a funny itch. Is that a mosquito or do I have cancer? I wonder when I can call my doctor. And what just happened back then? I have an itch. Did I have the wrong kind of thought? And a thought, you know, what happened? And so now we're into retrospective thinking. We've been derailed. We're no longer in the present moment. We've gone off into this kind of thinking about the itch. So equanimity is the ability to say, hold the course, stay balanced, don't be for or against anything, don't get caught up in the reactivity, don't hate something, don't love something, and thereby lose the next present moment as you plow ahead into the present moment, at the present moment. I don't know what you think of this analogy of time being an ocean or water, and that we're going in we're a boat heading into the next present moment, unless you stop, kind of. And we stop all the time. Mindfulness practice is the practice of not stopping. We keep going. We keep going. We stay in the present moment, or we learn how to be in the present moment with whatever's coming. And equanimity is the capacity to do that continuously as a part of the seven factors of awakening. There's also equanimity that is talked about in Buddhism in concentration practice. Concentration practice is laid out in a series of very dramatic quantum steps that moves through four different stages called jhanas, absorptions. And it goes through some wonderful experiences of joy and happiness. Sometimes it can be a rapture and bliss feeling almost because of the concentration. But the idea is that to really get into the depths of still mind, that you have to let go of the joy and the happiness that's there. And when those fall away, we're no longer interested in those things, that the mind is very, very still and quiet, the mind becomes very equanimous. So much so that for some people, it's the primary way it's primarily description of the state that they're in, the physical and mental state of being. Primarily, the whole state feels equanimous. So it isn't just like one particular, it's not like the captain at the rudder of the boat that keeps the boat going straight and straight, and captain's just one thing out of, you know, the whole boat. It's the whole boat is equanimous. It's the equanimity boat. Everything's equanimous. It's kind of very deep feeling of tranquility, of serenity, of peace that feels embodied and suffusing the whole body. It's a state where the equanimity is so strong that the ordinary experiences of the body as a solid body with kind of sharp boundaries kind of get diffuse and dissolve. And there's very little or no pain, no pleasure, except that this equanimous state is one of the most pleasant things you could imagine. It's just like one of the really, really sweet, but there's no physical pain or physical pleasure. It's just kind of almost like the body is porous or light or something, and through this light porous, there's a wafting an atmosphere or a wind of equanimity. It's quite phenomenal. So equanimity here is a state, not like a tracking your mind and seeing us. Don't get bothered with that. Don't be bothered with that. Then there's equanimity, which is another list, and that has to do with those four stages. There's these four stages of jhanas, four jhanas. There's also a whole series of steps, also a little bit quantum steps, changes in the path of vipassana practice, insight practice. When people do pure mindfulness practice, they go through these different phases, stages. And there also, the final stage has to do with equanimity. And I want to kind of give you a very simple overview of these stages of vipassana. They're called the insight knowledges. Because one way of understanding them is that they have to do with resolving or working through what's called, or coming to a new relationship, an equanimous relationship, with what's called the three characteristics. There's our tradition puts a tremendous emphasis on the characteristics that our experience, all our experiences are characterized in three ways. They are impermanent, inconstant. They are in some ways suffering, dukkha, unsatisfactory, and in some way they are not self. And so as we meditate and do mindfulness practice, at some point as the mind quiets down and begins no longer being caught up in its thoughts and ideas and where did the itch come from, and just staying present, it becomes very, very clear in a very stable present moment mind that everything's shifting and changing, the changing nature of phenomena. And things come and go. And to kind of rest in this flow, this current of change, it can be quite a blissful thing, quite a wonderful thing. But sometimes that's all this change, things coming and going, things going, can be also challenging. Because some people like to have stability. Some people want things to be unchanging, because then they hold on to it. And many people are orienting themselves in life through a stable sense of self, a stable sense of what they think is happening around them. And with very deep insight practice, there's no stability because everything is changing, everything is flowing. And so in order to keep moving along in the practice, there has to be a lot of equanimity, a lot of letting go, a lot of acceptance of how things are changing all the time. And so part of the path of vipassana is to learn a peace and equanimity and ease with how much things are changing. And it's a great life lesson because then you come out of meditation and it turns out there is a lot of change in our world. They turn off the electricity. And so, here, things are different. Things have changed. Okay, I know about change. And then as the practice deepens, then people will sometimes go through this next phase of practice that is the second characteristic, called dukkha. And so then they start feeling, having somehow come to terms with the aspect of human life that is suffering, that's painful, that feels unsatisfactory in some way, unsatisfactory for lasting happiness. And for some people, this is a difficult area to learn that. Some people have very strong aversion to pain and suffering. Some people get confused by it. Some people get overwhelmed by their own pain and suffering. Some people have huge backlog of unresolved suffering and emotions that they carry within them that are ready to come to the surface. And so as they sit in quietly and thinking they're just going to sit quietly and meditate and have a nice, quiet, peaceful time, all this unresolved stuff comes up, grief and difficulties and fear and sometimes with a tremendous sense of danger in the world. Is there going to be an earthquake? And do you have earthquake plans in case there is? And so in order to move through this phase of practice, a person has to learn equanimity about suffering, learn how to be non-reactive, learn not to get caught up in trying to fix it all the time, and treat every form of pain, every form of suffering and discomfort that we experience in meditation as something to be fixed. And to always be involved with trying to fix it and improve it or run away from it or change it. As soon as if we're too uncomfortable in meditation, then we get up and go off and do something different, and avoid it. And to, as the practice deepens, to be able to also be also find our comfort with discomfort, a different kind of equanimity. And so to be able to sit, well, this is painful. And I can breathe with ease. I cannot get wrapped up in my mind. I don't have to get contracted or tight or aversive. And then they move into another state where the mind now has moves through that and has developed a lot of equanimity, a lot of peace, a lot of being able to be present. And it becomes clearer and clearer that ideas of self, selfing, identification, me, myself, and mine, is an agitation of the mind. Me, myself, and mine, ideas having to do with me, myself, I'm talking about ideas, the assumptions, the imaginings we have about self, don't really make sense anymore. The mind gets so still that it's kind of like, I just heard, was that a car out there? I heard a car go by. It's pretty clear to me that that sound of the roar of the engine, that's not me. You know, it's, you know, I heard it, you know, but it's not, you know, that's out there, that's not me. To have arise in the mind the thought like, my meditation is lousy, or my meditation is good, and see that thought arise, and say, it's just like the car sound out there. It's just a thought. I don't have to believe it. I don't have to get involved in it. I don't have to identify it as me, myself, and mine having that thought. It's just a thought. I don't have to even, I don't have to believe it. Just a thought come up. But there's no me in that thought. The thought just arises. And this is one of the remarkable things about a very, very still, quiet mind, is that all these things that we often take to be me, in the moment-to-moment appearance, in the very subtle details of the moment, it's clear it's not self. It's like you're sitting, minding your own business in meditation, and suddenly, with no plan of your own, you start thinking about a song that you sang in high school. You haven't sung that song or thought about it for 20, 30 years. Where did that come from? I didn't plan it. I didn't want it. It just popped up. And that thought is that you. See, you know, that's not me. It's just I don't know where it came from, the unconscious, but I don't identify it. I don't take it myself. It's just a thing floating up, like looking in the sky and seeing a cloud going through the sky. Just see it. It's just a thought. So you start seeing, as the mind gets deeper, that all these little details of thoughts, of impulses, of ideas, of feelings, that it's no self in that. And remarkably even, that the ability to watch all this, there's no watcher. There's just watching, but there's no watcher, because to posit a watcher is actually an extra layer of agitation. It's not needed. It's not like someone else is watching. Of course, you're the one who's watching. But with the mind to latch onto it, that's who I am, the watcher. That's extra. And to sit so equanimous and so still that we're not latching on to self, we're not making things into self, we're not, there isn't an taking something, this is who I am, or this negative kind of thing, this is not who I am, let me explain to you now how this is not me, because this is, you know. All this stuff around self, that's kind of self game that human beings play, to be in this very quiet, serene state of mind where we begin questioning and seeing how we construct a self and then seeing the agitation, the restlessness, the compulsions that are operating, and have them, all this compulsivity around self drop away, then the final stage of the stages of insight is equanimity towards everything. Imagine that. So no matter what you experience, whatever comes up in meditation, anything that arises, anything you become aware of, it's really clear the mind has now become completely equanimous, meaning it doesn't go, it doesn't react, it doesn't go towards it, it doesn't go away from it, it doesn't push it, it doesn't hold on to it, it doesn't lean into it, it doesn't make anything out of it, it doesn't make a story out of it, it doesn't make a self out of it, it just, things are just there. And generally in this state, the equanimity is so deep and the peace is so deep that things that arise just seem almost like they're floating in this kind of vast ocean of peace or stillness. Just things are there, they come, they go, very, very peaceful. And they say that this very deep state of equanimity, of peace, where we're not... So in the first stage, we're working through our equanimity and peace with how things change. The second, we're working out our relationship to how things are difficult. And the third stage, we're working out our relationship to kind of the selfing and wanting and me and mine. And so to have worked through these three and came to a place where you're actually able to stay peaceful and non-reactive and just letting things be as they are in a very still and quiet way, then a remarkable thing happens. And that is that I'm trying to think of a new analogy. I saw this when I was took my little kids to these museums, exploratoriums, science museums. Some of them had these big bowls that might have been 5 feet wide or something, really big. And at the bottom of the bowl, they had a little hole, just about the size of a marble, maybe a teeny bit larger. And then they had these marbles lined up on the edge the kids could drop into this bowl. And the marbles would just go up and down the sides and around, whatever way you threw in the marbles. If you sent them sideways, they'd spin around and around and around, or straight down to the middle, they'd go jump right over that hole and keep going. And mostly, whenever it came over the hole, if there's a lot of momentum in the marble, it would just keep going. It would jump over the hole, past the hole. But the marbles would eventually slow down more and more. And so when they first throw out the marbles, they are, you can say there's a lot of momentum, there's a lot of agitation in them. And we say in English that someone's marbles are loose, right? So, most of our marbles are all loose in our head, and there's a lot of momentum. We've been spinning them and throwing them out for a long time, and then we get in there and we push them, keep them going. But if we finally stop pushing our marbles, throwing new marbles in to our head, and it all gets, the momentum goes down and quieter, so the marbles begin kind of in less momentum, they go slower, they're going, don't go so high up the edges anymore, and come down and slower and slower and slower. And then they come to a place where they're almost so still, they almost, looks like they might stop as they come over that hole at the bottom. And when they kind of go over that place, plop, they fall through. And so in meditation, your marbles get slower and slower, slower and slower. And then finally, you're so quiet that you come to that place where you can finally let go in a deep way. Finally let go. Now maybe it's this idea of the analogy of, falling through the hole in the bowl is frightening. But it's a great place when the other side of you knows what's under there. In the museum, we don't know. Usually the marbles come back. And so that happens to us too. We come, we drop through the hole and we come back also, don't worry. But we come back transformed, become changed in some way. And one way it's been transformed is we know how good it is to let go. And we know how good it is to be, how appropriate it is and how healthy it is to be equanimous to all things, to not hold on, not be so reactive. And to learn the outer reaches or the most furthest stretches or greatest possibilities of really letting go, letting go, just letting go of everything for a moment. It's a life lesson. It's phenomenal. So all these treasures, from the Buddhist point of view, we have a tremendous amount of treasure inside. We have all this riches that we can cultivate and develop. And you could just develop a lot of them, and just it's portable. You can take them with you. They're much more compelling, much more valuable than a lot of things that people pursue in life. But as you cultivate these, from a Buddhist point of view, these beautiful, wonderful qualities grow as we do this path of practice. And some people, because as they grow, they trust the path of practice more and more. They trust, this is good to do this. It's good to grow this way. It's good to develop these things. And then as they grow and develop, that supports this process of the marble slowing down. And generally, not always, but sometimes it's, you go through the difficult stages. You have to work through your relationship to suffering. But generally it goes, it really feels right, really feels good. So much so that you're ready for you're ready when the time comes for your marble to drop through the hole, to really let go. And it's been a great journey all the way there. And one of the great parts about this practice, I think, is that because it's so good all along the way, you don't have to go the whole way. The Buddhism offers a whole path, but it's not necessary to go the whole path. It's just necessary to discover how good it is to be present here and now, and to really feel a satisfaction of this moment, and really feel connected to here, and not be agitated about where you're going and what you're getting. Then you stop the boat. But if you can really be content and settled and mindful in some deep way here, then it's onward leading through the water. And if the boat takes you to the bowl, I guess you're not allowed to mix metaphors, are you? then great. And if it doesn't, it's been a great trip. It's been a great adventure, a great life. So, to be equanimous with this moment, and then discover what this moment has to offer. So, those are my thoughts, I hope they were okay. Did they suddenly lose the sound? Did they go down? Yeah, I think okay, but you can turn it up again now, I think. So that was my thoughts, and just what I had to say coming from a retreat. I hope that was okay, and hopefully I wasn't too calm, too equanimous. I was going to tell a story. I forgot. But I have 5 minutes. Do you want to hear a little story? Equanimity story? I told it at the retreat for the first talk in equanimity. I told the story, equanimity story. It's a nice story, I think. There was a Zen priest and teacher, monk in Japan some 200 years ago named Hakuin, and a somewhat famous teacher. And he was a village priest and had a village temple where he lived. And there was a teenager in the village who got pregnant. And when the parents realized this, they were upset and they demanded to know who the father was. And it was, in fact, a teenage boy in the village, but she didn't want it to tell the parents because she didn't want to get the boy in trouble. So she said, "It's Hakuin, the village priest." So when the baby was born, the parents brought the baby to Hakuin and said, this is yours. And he said in Japanese, ah, so desu ka, which means, is that so? And he took the baby and took care of the baby. And you can imagine maybe what his reputation, what it did to his reputation in the village, and what it did to his sleep, and all kinds of things. But he said, okay. He said, is that so? And then after some time, the mother decided to tell the parents who the real father was. So she did, and then the parents came to Hakuin and said, there's been a mistake, we're sorry, we'd like the baby back. And so Hakuin said, oh, is that so? And he did. So, is that so? Is an equanimity phrase. Would that be a useful phrase for you to carry in your back pocket? You leave today and you look for your car and you have a flat tire. Oh, is that so? Try it. Is that so? You go home today and electricity is still off or it's turned off. Is that so? As opposed to, oh. Which would you rather live by? You'd rather live with, oh. Or would you rather live with, is that so? Oh, is that so? Okay. I'll live with this. I'll take care of this baby. Oh. The baby of your flat tire, or the baby of no electricity, whatever it might be. So you might try that this week. Think about equanimity. As a little experiment, just try to keep that, maybe write it on notes or something carried with you, or write it in the palm of your hand. Is that so? And then use it whenever you remember to use it and see what that does for you. Does that change your perspective of what's happening or change how you are and what's available to you? Is that so? And if you want to do it in Japanese, it's not a word. It's more like kind of like in English. But I like to think of it as wow. They say ah, and how you say that in Japanese is a world of meanings. Ah. So anyway, ah, so desu ka. So, but in English, we could maybe you want to try, wow. Is that so? I like wow because it's kind of like makes it more exciting. Ah, desu ka. Ah, desu ka. Ah, desu ka. Ah, desu ka. So, you are now prepared for the next power outage. Thank you.